Hello, good evening and welcome to the Wall Over Podcast, the only rugby podcast that gives you the news, views and opinion on the weekend's rugby action, or with a West Country accent. You can find us on Twitter, we are at Wall Over Rugby Podcast. No, we're not, we're at Wall Over Podcast, aren't we? We're at Wall Over Rugby Podcast on Facebook. You can find all of our stuff on Anchor and Apple Pods and Google Store and I think Spotify and lots of other places. But you already know that if you're listening to us by now. I'm Russ. I host this thing. And this week I'm joined by Housewife's favourite, veterinary professional, Phil Elkins. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm very good. Thank you. How are you, Russ?
Very well. Tired, mate. I'm tired. I was up late last night, but that's another story. And everybody's favourite, not according to the Twitter poll that we did a few weeks ago, but yeah, I think the people's champ, Ben Eustace. How are you doing, Ben?
Yeah, I was going to say that was completely factually inaccurate, wasn't it?
It was. I think your fans needed to vote for you a little bit more.
Yeah,
everybody votes for Doug, didn't they?
Yeah, poor old Matt could only vote so many times, couldn't he?
I don't know, yeah, I think he's got an unhealthy obsession with you, Ben, I think.
The problem is that Doug's audience is the Twitter audience. Your audience, Russ, is the Facebook audience. Ben is the Instagram generation. and I'm clearly off... Tinder.
You said Grindr first.
Freudian that, wasn't it?
Amazing. I trust you both had a good weekend. Lots of rugby on. Six Nations was back. The reason I'm tired is I stayed up for the Super Bowl last night. Weirdly, I'm recording this podcast from Doug's front room, but Doug isn't here. Now,
where is he?
Doug is out having dinner with his dad and his auntie and his girlfriend, whilst I am sitting in his house, drinking his beer and yeah, recording a podcast.
It's not gone all a bit Fritzl up there, is it?
A little bit Joseph.
Yeah, are you free to leave, Russ?
That would be awkward, wouldn't it? If Doug traps me in,
just blink twice for yes.
He beat me at golf today as well, and I have to admit that early, but I did give him a few shots, but he played very well, so I'm sure he'll remind everybody of that as we go through the weeks. Shall we talk about some Six Nations action?
Seems a good place to start.
Good. Right, so let's start at the Millennium Stadium, because that's what it's called, isn't it? Let's be fair. The Principality. A new generation of Welsh team under Shane Pivac. Why can't I remember his name?
But everybody's taken to calling him Wayne Pivac.
Pivac, it's not Pivac, is it?
It's Pivac.
It's got to be Pivac. It's always been Pivac. Against an Italy side, it's hard to describe. No, it's not actually. It's not hard to describe Italy's performance, is it? Because Italy were gash at best. I can't remember a worse. Well, in fact, until England on Sunday, a worse first half or a worse performance from a Six Nations side. It was dreadful.
Yeah, I don't think there's much more to say than that, is there? I mean, Italy, they haven't won now for God knows how long. Was it 35, 36 Six Nations games on the bounce, something like that? But historically, you would always expect them to be in a fight in the first half and then just get overpowered, out-fitnessed, substitutes don't really step up to the mark. And then the teams in the second half come on and score a hat load of points. Frankly, the scoreline at half time kind of didn't really do any justice to how poor Italy were. And I think we can't keep having the same conversations again and again about how crap Italy are without somebody, not saying that they listen to us, people generally can't keep having the same conversations without somebody at the Six Nations going, we need to change this. Whatever it is, it needs to be changed. Whether that's a promotion relegation playoff, whether that's a two-tier system, whether that's going back to five nations, I don't really know. But it's a something needs to change because it's not doing Italy any favours and it's not doing anybody else any favours.
No, agree. I mean, looking at, you know, Georgia played Romania on Sunday in what's the Rugby Europe Championship. Russia, Spain, which was 31-12 to Spain. Georgia beat Romania 41-13 and Portugal beat Belgium 23-17. And there are, you know, those six teams that are in the second tier, sort of below the Six Nations as such. So could it be that they would look to run a relegation playoff at some point, maybe at the start of the summer tour window between those two sides that finish bottom and top of those respective leagues, Ben, do you reckon?
Well, I'm not sure at the moment Georgia would beat Italy.
No, but at least they've got the opportunity.
Yeah, I do think they should perhaps start pushing Georgia in the, you know, further in the right direction. I mean, I can't see any reason other than cold hard cash why the Georgians shouldn't be a warm-up game for the Lions. I think that'd be a great idea. You know, I think I just want to echo what Phil said really about Italy in that they used to make a mess of a game and they were hard to beat. Whereas these guys were just beating themselves. You know, whenever they did make a break, they would just try and offload, forgetting they're not Sonny Bill Williams. You know, they were trying to flip balls off the ground. There was a lot of stuff coming out of the back of the hand where it didn't really need to. And, you know, they tried for the sort of 10-12 Mike Catt, Johnny Wilkinson axis, but they forgot that your 10 and 12 have to be half decent first. If you're paying a 10 and 12 just to sum up one decent fly half, that's not quite the point. It's supposed to add creativity. And, you know, they just kick the ball down Halfpenny's throat for the whole game. And Halfpenny, he's not quite as attacking as Liam Williams, but he's always going to be stood in the right place. And if you're just going to kick aimlessly, he's going to run it back at you. And that's what he did.
Yeah. And I've seen a lot of, I saw a lot of comments and stuff about Halfpenny and Wales attack in general at the weekend. And people saying, oh, Lee Halfpenny's attacking prowess is often underrated. And I was like, I don't kind of believe that to be true. Like you just said, Italy kicked the ball straight down his throat.
Yeah. I mean, he's not a complete car.
He's not crap. You know, he's not rubbish by any stretch of imagination.
I just think Wales, I think within 10 minutes, Wales had kind of twigged that they didn't really need to get out of third gear to get the bonus point. So they didn't try and cut loose because there was no need to. I mean, the real plus for them was, well, Faletau getting through the game until he, you know, he was just rested. And obviously Tompkins, I mean, at least England didn't need a centre who could cut a line anyway.
So I know we've all been critical of the rankings in the past and the way they work, but they tell a story. And what they tell at the moment is no team other than Scotland can win any ranking points by beating Italy. That's how bad they are that it's considered.
Phil, are you in a washing machine?
No. There might be a cup of tea being made in the background.
Oh, lovely.
So no team apart from Scotland can win any ranking points. So it's effectively a given that Italy are going to lose. That's how bad they are.
They just didn't offer very much, did they?
No. And it's a shame because they just are struggling for halfbacks, aren't they? They've got a good back row.
Pellegrini was decent, to be fair to him, and he's always going to be because he's a big, strong, angry man.
Yeah, they had some young props who did pretty well, I would say. But you know, that used to be their real strength, didn't it? Their set piece, and
yeah,
they don't really have that to fall back on anymore.
They were always solid, weren't they? Almost to the point of dependable in the set piece. Whereas, you know, and you know what looked like it was lacking to me in Italy's play was any real leadership. And I know that's going to be difficult now that Parisse's sort of retired. I know they're going to bring him back for the England game to a certain extent, aren't they? And let him have a farewell in Rome. But that lack of leadership for Italy, it is going to be a bit of a transitional period for them.
Yeah, very much so. And the one thing I would say is the substitute that came on, I think he was Lazzaroni, the bold-headed second row. I thought he actually showed a few decent flashes because they were very lightweight, you know, particularly in the row. And I thought he should be in with a shout, I would have thought, of a game next week. But, you know, other than that, I mean, great bit of skill by Bigger for one of the tries.
The through the legs piece.
Yeah, I thought Hadley Parks played pretty well as well. Yeah.
What did you make of the Parks and North partnership? They didn't really have to do much, did they?
I just think North's a better winger than he is centre. And somehow I think we might end up talking about players playing out of position a bit later on and how it's not an ideal option. And if you've got Tompkins playing so well, I that would be my choice, and I'd probably just move North back to the wing.
Well, I got a bit of pelters on Twitter for saying that the wingers weren't going to get any ball with Parks and Adam and North inside them. Oh, but Adam's got a hat trick. But none of those tries came from a pass from any of the starting centres. The first one actually came from Tompkins when he was on as a temporary replacement. But I don't know. It doesn't. It was. It just doesn't inspire. It doesn't inspire 15-man rugby having two centres who are not renowned for their passing ability or unselfishness. Not saying that Hadley Parks is selfish because he plays a role and he plays that role very well, but that role is not as a distributor.
It was nothing short of sort of Gatland ball again, wasn't it? Tough.
Yeah.
And against better teams, they're going to have to be a lot more inventive than they were against Italy. It must be nice for any of the Six Nations, well, other than Italy, to open their campaign with a home game against Italy.
I'm sure Italy would love to start with a home game against Italy. They might have a chance of winning something.
Well, that Italy team would find a way for them both to lose if they played.
But what do we learn from this game? That Nick Tompkins is an international class centre. That's about the only thing that we learned. Everything else was pretty much known and a given.
I think we probably learned that Dan Bigg is the form 10.
He's very good.
Yeah, but
we might.
You know what? He probably has been for 6 months.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a very, very good player. Let's move on from Wales, Italy, because it was, you know, it was an arsing of biblical proportions, really, 42-0. And move on to the Aviva Stadium on Saturday evening, the Ireland-Scotland game. Poor Caelan Doris on his debut, going off after 5 minutes with a head injury concussion. He didn't know what day it was, did he? He got a bang in the chest. Was it Kean Healy? It was one of his own players, wasn't it, that he came together with, and he was absolutely wiped out cold. But it was a pretty abject first half in a way for me. Scotland did all of the right things, made all of the right noises, and it sort of followed a similar pattern throughout the game, really. And they just every single time that they got the ball in a position to score, they found a way to fuck it up. And it was, you know, they did all of the hard work to get themselves into positions and then just ballsed it up. And, you know, a lot of credit goes to Ireland's defence, but I think Scotland were as bad in that area of the pitch as Ireland were good, Ben.
Yeah, well, it's an old problem for Scotland, you know, probably for the last 10 to 15 years, that it's been a sort of feature that they've got into 5 or 10 metres out and been unable to finish it off. And I think they've cut that out in the last few years by scoring from distance.
Yeah.
You know, I thought Hastings played pretty well, but, you know, without Russell, it's slightly different setup there.
Well, I heard a bit of an interesting story about this. I heard through an unnamed source that Finn Russell wasn't actually that drunk to be kicked out of the squad and the whole team protocol. So apparently it was nothing to do with the booze. Not entirely sure what happened, but World War III between Russell and Townsend when he arrived after the Saracens Racing match. Finn was at the team hotel for less than 90 minutes. His lawyer told him not to say anything more at the moment, and Racing are all over it. And I believe they are hoping that the SRU make an ill-advised statement so they can get him on that. Scottish Rugby haven't really made any comment other than leaving him out of the squad again for the Calcutta Cup this weekend. Apparently the relationship between Russell and Townsend broke down after Twickenham last year. Again, Finn Russell might have had a beer or two, which loosened his lips a little bit, but it wasn't the fact that he was drunk or, you know, disorderly contact. It was an argument with Townsend.
Missed training on the Monday as well.
He was sent home, wasn't he?
I thought that was after he'd missed training. I thought he'd gone out, he didn't get to training on time, and maybe he didn't get to training because he'd had a bust up with Townsend. And then for not being there, that's why they kicked him out. I don't know. It's all the bottom line is you've got a player like that. There's obviously a degree of, let's call it, ego involved. It's Townsend's job to make it work or not work. I think the Scots have got to trust him on that.
They do, but equally, as good as Finn Russell is, you know, and he can do some magical stuff. I thought Adam Hastings had a really good game.
Yeah.
I thought he was solid.
But I suppose I'm not saying Finn Russell is in any way Marlon Yard, but when he left Quinns, nobody was crying about it. Everybody seemed relatively happy that he was gone because I think he was quite disruptive within the group. Equally, there's no noise coming out of the rest of the Scottish camp going, oh, I wish Finn Russell was here. It's a shame that he's not been here. They all seem fairly unified in their stance on it, whether that be official or unofficial.
Well, the rumour was, wasn't it, that at Twickenham at half-time, with Scotland getting a thorough assing at the time, that Townsend said to stay with the plan and Russell basically told him he was talking out of his arse and they needed to change it up a bit. So whether it's been, like Russ said, brewing since then, and if that is the case, then probably sticking up for Finn probably isn't the best career move right now in the Scotland squad, possibly.
Yeah, you need to side with the coach if you want to play.
Yeah. I just think, you know, Scotland, there were some pretty decent performances there. Like, is it Johnson in the centres? I thought he played really well.
Yeah, I thought Johnson was good.
But, you know, the Irish just, they were too dogged in defence, weren't they? You know, Stander with a couple of turnovers, thought he had a really good game, and they just couldn't get across the line, and
they stuck to task, didn't they? The Irish weren't brilliant really by any stretch of the imagination, especially in attack.
Well, I think they just dogged it out, didn't they? You know, what I thought was very odd was Bayfield's interviews at the end of the match.
I didn't see them, but I saw you commented on it.
Well, I can't remember the exact phrase, but he basically just went, you know, Omani's come off the pitch, hard fought win. You feel pretty good defending on your line like that. And then he pretty much said, well, you were pretty terrible. You've been lucky to get away with that. And he kind of looked at him and then he looked at him a bit longer. And I think he was just sort of sizing up if it was wise to hit a man that big. And in the end, he just went, I'll have to disagree with you there. And then he kind of did it a bit with Townsend as well. He kind of went, you must be really disappointed. Townsend kind of said, not that disappointed. I thought we played quite well. It was very odd, I thought. It's just, you know, because I thought O'Driscoll and Wilkinson and McGeecham were pretty good in the studio.
Oh, yeah, that I meant to say that about the Italy-Wales game with Jonathan Davis, Faf de Klerk, Michael Checker, the other Jonathan Davis on comms. It was quite the eclectic mix the Wales game. But you're right, Wilkinson, O'Driscoll and McGeecham were, you know, they knocked spots off those other guys.
Which is why they got the game that was likely to be interesting.
I bet ITV paid them as well.
I do think, though, that if you look at Wales and Ireland, they've got new coaches in, they've got opportunities to switch things around in terms of how they play. You look at the teams that have been produced and the way that they've played, and it's pretty much sticking with the same formula. It's more of the same. And it's understandable why, from the Farrell perspective, obviously having been part of that wider Ireland setup. But I don't know, I just hoped for a bit more inventiveness, openness from one of the two sides. I get the whole, we've got something that works to a point, why change it? But I just hope for a bit more,
evolution, not revolution.
Yeah, evolution, not more of the same. A bit more, actually, we've got this and we know it achieves that. Let's try adding something a little bit different. Ireland know what they do and they do it bloody well, apart from in the World Cup. Scotland know what they do and they do that bloody well, which is turned down scoring opportunities for the last 15 years. And the match was almost a parody of Ireland-Scotland over the last 10 years. It's Ireland not necessarily playing particularly pretty rugby, but dogging things out and doing the dog work very well. Scotland looking pretty good and pretty impressive until they get anywhere near the opposition's try line and then doing a Stuart Hogg.
That was one of the worst pieces of rugby from a player of his caliber, or any player of any caliber that does that. I mean, it wasn't as even as if he knocked it on. He just tried. I don't know what he was thinking, because he was just trying to. It was when he celebrated the try afterwards as well.
Yeah. I'll try and style this out,
knowing full well that he dropped the ball and he absolutely, you know, he ballsed it right up. But yeah, I thought Scotland were unlucky. I thought that, you know, the last penalty that gave Ireland the win, or allowed them to shut the game out, I thought that was a bit harsh. The French referee was very liberal at the breakdown, I thought.
Yeah,
as they always are.
But still managed to be fussy enough to break the game up especially in the first half.
Yeah.
Was that the penalty you're talking about there, Russ? Was that the blocking run on the kick chase?
No, this was the last penalty right on the Irish line.
It was
they went for a few phases.
Standard turnover.
Turnover, but because on the penalty that the Irish won, where I think it was Johnson, you know, he did run a blocking line. But I thought they were quite lucky not to get that turned round, because Hastings called a mark and then two Irish defenders absolutely wasted
him. Yeah, they destroyed him. Yeah, Johnson ran into Henshaw, Ring Rose maybe. Oh no, it was Conway, Andrew Conway, wasn't it? And he changed his line to get in his way. But you're right, they absolutely murdered Hastings, didn't they, off the back of the mark? Yeah. And it wasn't committed. It wasn't. We're committed. We have to go for it. They had plenty of time to pull out of that. 100%. Should we move on? A solid start for Ireland, you know, 4 points in the bag. They entertain Wales this week, they go to Wales or entertain Wales. Either way, I think it's going to be an interesting game for both teams to see how Wales come off the back of that, the Italy humping, and how Ireland bounce back from a pretty abject performance against Scotland. that's it at the Aviva on Saturday lunchtime. Saturday evening, 16:45, is Scotland versus England, Calcutta Cup. Let's talk a little bit before we talk about the Calcutta Cup about England and their performance yesterday in Paris.
I was going to say, before we get into England, can we just, because I feel like there's going to be a bit of a slating going on, and rightly so, but I don't really want to lose the fact that France were absolutely amazing in that game. Like, France are the team that come out of this weekend looking the best, without a shadow of a doubt, as far as I'm concerned. Like, they did everything right.
Yes, yes and no. For me, I thought the French were good. I thought the fact that, you know, it's a new side coming together. I mean, I think Dupont is an absolute, I think he's a great player, and Untermac will he go down the Freddie Michelet route of being an amazing player in fits and starts, or will he be more consistent? Fiku and Vakatawa, you know, Fiku's entirely functional. Vakatawa's X Factor. Then you've got Teddy Thomas and who was the other winger that came in for Penno? He scored the try, who had a really good game.
Rates. Did you see the nose on him?
What a beak.
That was like Concord.
But, yeah. And the fullback, Baltier, who I thought had a really good game. But what made it for me for the French was the level of intensity that came from their defence in the first half. They did not allow England a second, didn't give them a meter. You know, England were going into the 22, they were going through phases, and the next thing you know, they've gone through another three phases and they're 15 meters back. It's just, they were all over the place. Manu Tuilagi going off. Do you think that had a big impact? Do you think it was as bigger impact as people were saying?
Well, yeah, I think it had to, because the team is effectively built around Billy. So I think they were going to use Tuilagi a lot more as a sort of surrogate. And then he went off as well. And then they tried to use Jonathan Joseph in the same way, and that really didn't work. Yeah, what you said about the French defence is absolutely right. I think they had the five top tacklers, and the number eight, Audrey, you know, he was brilliant as well. But it was very
speed in the middle, wasn't it?
They were just pushing, like you say, England back. I think England averaged just over a meter a carry.
So did it make as big of a difference as people say? No, because it never makes as big of a difference as people say, because people are idiots. But did it make a massive difference to Lange? Yes, because in the first 5 minutes, actually, he took a... And as much as he didn't make great yardage, he sucked people in, and you could see that they were using him in the way that he should be used. Mm. Whereas... certainly World Cup final, various other Leicester games, they use him more as a decoy. But as you've said multiple times, Ben, to be a good decoy, there's got to be a threat that every so often you're actually going to get it. And the first 5 minutes, it looked pretty promising. It looked brutal, but it looked pretty promising. And then it all...
And then France scored.
Yeah.
Well, once Thomas scored that try, England didn't seem to know how to react to it. And it was a good try. I think the defence was poor, but they worked it well. I think Underhill missed the tackle off the ruck, and they came through and went through a couple of sets of hands, and Thomas went over. But England never recovered from that. And, you know, we can celebrate the French line speed and say, you know, what a fantastic job Sean Edwards has done getting them prepped and their defence ready for this game. But England made some pretty, you know, rudimentary errors. You know, every time England took the ball into contact, it seemed that they were spilling it out the guts. There was routine passes going down from Furbank and Farrell. you know, the France rush defence was up in England faces very, very quickly. But how often did you see England try and chip in behind? How often did you see England, you know, every single ball carrier, you know, whenever we got to their 22, the amount of times that Sinclair and Itoje and Laws took the ball from Youngs, which was horrifically slow, by the way. His service was beyond slow yesterday. It was always from a standing start. No, we had nobody ever attacking the ball at pace, which meant we had no chance of ever getting over the gain line. Now, when you've got Billy and Mako to a certain extent, off a standing start, those guys can usually get a little bit of go forward. What England didn't have was any ability to go forward whatsoever.
You go, Ben.
I was just going to say, it's partly because the eight didn't pick up from the back of the scrum once.
No, and because it's not, he's not an eight.
Because he's a seven, and I'm not criticising Tom Curry at all. He did his best, you know, in what was a pretty ropey situation for him, because and England's pack actually in the scrums was doing pretty well, so they needed some control at the back there. Phil probably knows better than me, but I don't think they made the most of the go forward they had there, because he wasn't used to dealing with it.
Was it the first scrum? They left the ball behind?
Yeah,
the ball came out about a foot to Curry's left, and he left it. Now, your job as a flanker is to push, is to primarily hold your prop in nice and tight, get an angle, get a shove on, be a nuisance to their nine, and 95% of the time you don't need to worry about the ball. Occasionally it'll squirt out and you've got to give it a little nudge. As an eight, after you make that initial shove, your focus needs to be entirely on the ball. And if that was an experienced eight there, it doesn't need to be Billy, any experienced eight, probably even someone like Chris Robshaw's played more at eight than Curry, would have seen that ball, would have changed the channel that they were in and moved across and got their foot on the ball straight away. And that ball's ours. Now, I think you're right, Russ. There was no go forwards ball and the forwards were taking it static. I think part of the reason they were taking it static was because they were expecting it a second before it comes out. Because you look, the ball's there, nine's bending over, that's when you make your run. And Youngs was bending over to pick it up, then getting up looking, then bending back down, then putting his hands on the ball, then a second later picking it up, and then taking two steps before he passed it. You can't time anything off that. It's just too slow. But to me, yes, there's significant personnel issues. We'll get into that and we'll discuss it. But to me, the big problem, and we've said it pretty much every time that Billy's not been available in an Eddie Jones team, or Tua Lange's not been there, and there isn't a bit of bulk in the middle, is they've got plan A and they've got no concept what to do when plan A doesn't work. And is that overcoaching, or is that there's nobody on the field? Like, you can guarantee if Finn Russell was on the field, they wouldn't have kept doing the same thing and getting screwed over by it. He would have changed it up and tried something differently. You can guarantee if Cipriani was on the field, he would have changed something and done something different. Now, I'm not saying we should be playing Cipriani. What I'm saying is there's a problem with this England setup, whereby they do plan A, and if plan A doesn't work, they keep doing plan A.
He kept
going for one-out runners, and one-out runners was getting nowhere. They needed to go two out with a forward, or they needed to start shifting the ball out to the wing. If you look at the tries, it's because we got the ball out wide. I can't think of the ball time we got the ball out wide.
It's interesting, because I mentioned before that they had the blitz defence really, really high, the French. And like you've said, the one-out runners, and I listened to the Egg Chasers today, again, breaking my usual golden rule, but the valid point is England England thought that they would just keep peppering away at France, just keep one out, two out, whatever, and eventually the French would crumble, but they didn't. It was England that crumbled, and we would knock the ball on, or we would give away a penalty for holding on. And it was just, you know, it was littered. The first half was littered with individual errors, as I mentioned, Furbank and Farrell. Laws knocked on a couple of times. Sinclair did. We can talk about the Olivon try where, you know, what's the first thing you're taught as a kid to do?
To tie your laces up.
Cool, Ben.
I was going to say, I mean, May, two fantastic tries, but Yodis won.
Yeah.
Because he just, like you say, just stopped playing. I mean, did you hear Johnson at halftime?
No.
He just went, I'd have wiped him out, whistle or no whistle.
Yeah, well, exactly right.
You know, and that's, it was just, with May, am I right in saying he picked up rugby quite late? And I think sometimes he just, he's not almost natural in what he does. Yeah. And, you know, I think he just sort of almost froze a little bit with that ball. Because it was a slightly weird situation, wasn't it? In that it had been charged down and then it looked very much like a knock on the replay. But I guess, you know, they're looking for something clear and obvious. So fair enough.
Of course.
But what I'm saying is perhaps, you know, it just, you know, he just froze in the 1 second and
you know, it was very gone.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was bad play. And as I say, he did owe us a couple of tries and fair play. He did come and score two crackers. So, you know, fair play to him. But even once he scored, you know, we got down in their 22, but didn't really look like scoring at any stage. No. You know, I think some of our subs came on and did pretty well. Genge especially.
I want to give a special, sorry, Phil. I want to give a big special, no. A special shout out to Genge and Ludlam because they are both quite angry looking young men, aren't they? but they added that when they came on. They seemed to come on and add a bit of bite to England. I mean, the first thing Genge did was absolutely marmalise Untermak, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And you know, had a little bit of a fracas or whatever. And you know, you got then Cowan Dickey being abrasive as well. All those mewling Irish and Welshmen saying, oh, he needs to be sighted. I'm sick of these cheap shots. Fucking bore off, mate. What a load of rubbish. After the French scored their third try there. I just, you know, that's what England needed from their team yesterday, but it came 60 minutes too late.
Yeah.
Well, you lose Billy, Billy's not there, Mako's not in the team, and then you lose Tuilagi. So you've lost three big ball-carrying options. So what do you replace them with? You shift it round and put a second row on the flank. You've got Joe Marler, who will do anything to avoid having to carry the ball. And you've got Jonathan Joseph taking a crash ball. We had our three biggest carrying players sat on the bench for 60 minutes and our biggest carrying back sat on the bench for 70-odd minutes. Like, get Genge, Cowan Dickey, Ludlam. If you're gonna pick Devoto, particularly for playing against France, and Tuilagi goes off, you stick Devoto on as quick as possible. I get that Joseph is a highly talented player, and I really like Joseph, but if you've got Ford and Farrell inside, they need an out ball.
And Jonathan Joseph, I thought that they took a bit too long to realise and move, you know, and I didn't think George Ford didn't have his best game. I don't think he had his worst game. He just didn't do anything. It was just, you know, it was one of those. He didn't make any particularly poor mistakes. But when he went off and Farrell moved inside and we had Devoto and Joseph, all of a sudden we looked like we could attack the outside shoulders.
Yeah.
And we had that ability. Whereas previously they were trying to send Joseph in up the guts into the big hard lines. And he's not that type of player. He's an on the outside shoulder type man. And this is where unless you've got a relatively passive defence, or you've got the ability to read it heads up and put the chip kicks in and stuff, this is where having Ford and Farrell in the 10-12 axis, or the two playmakers, doesn't that just have to be Ford Farrell? Because they know that Farrell isn't going to run that hard 12 line off 10. So essentially, you're playing with two 10s, and he's going to be a second standoff, which means your 13 has to do that hard carrying. Now, when you've got Manu Tuilagi, fine. That's no problem because he will do that job. But when Farrell, when Tuilagi went off, I think Farrell has to assume some responsibility and look to do a little bit more carrying. He does it. If he's going to play 12, he needs to carry the ball a bit more.
Well, the thing is, when Tuilagi took his couple of balls early, he was taking them either off nine or off a fairly flat forward. And he was keeping their defence honest. He was stopping their line speed by doing that, which made the space out the back. As soon as he went, the French line speed just stepped up. And what happened was Ford went 5 yards further back. Farrell went 5 yards behind him. And all of a sudden, we're playing rugby 20 yards back without a viable, hard-carrying threat. Ford put in a couple of pretty good territorial kicks, but there was nothing there looking to exploit the space at all. And as I say, it comes back to the, we have a game plan and we're going to stick to our game plan, whatever the personnel. And it doesn't work. You can't replace Billy with Courtney Laws playing at six.
And that is been a criticism of this England side for quite a while, isn't it? Is the ability to switch when things aren't. And we don't know whether that is a coaching point, whether that is something they're not allowed to do. They've got to stick to the plan. We don't know. We've had a couple of questions in around the England setup. Driving more. So, Paul, hello. Will Eddie ever pick players in their positions? And a follow-up question is that from Ben G is, will Eddie ever pick the best players in their positions? We've mentioned the Curry 8 debate. You know, we've got Don Brandt and Simmons and, you know, Nathan Hughes, whose ship's probably sailed, and Tamana Harrison the same. If we're not careful, I know Doug mentioned this last week, if we're not careful, Alex Don Brandt could become the new Don Armand and Danny Cipriani. So if we just ignore it and speak about it.
I think the thing is with Eddie, it's almost like what's happened with the All Blacks over the past 10, 15 years. You get in, they have a look at you. If they don't like you, you're out, and that's it. Your chance is gone. If your face doesn't fit at a certain time, you're no longer on the list, the pool for people to be picked from. And I don't think it's the right way to do it. I expect at some point we'll probably all go through what we would like to see for the next game. But it has to be people playing in their positions. This whole second rows playing at six thing is a pile of horseshit, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, Ben.
Yeah, well, you know my views on that as well. I don't think it's ever worked. Whether it's, you know, players as good as Itoje and Laws, it just doesn't seem to work.
Just while you're there, when were England at their best at the World Cup with Curry and Underhill at six and seven?
What makes it even stranger is, okay, you've moved Curry to eight, so then you've got Mobile eight, you've got Mobile seven, you've brought Yules into the second row, who's pretty mobile, and then you put a second row in the back row, so your six is less mobile than it was in the last game. So there's no even consistency there. To me, I think, you know, I like Don Brandt. I think he's a very good player, but I don't want to get carried away, and he's not the answer. You know, he's not 100% going to cure everything, but at least he plays number eight.
Yeah.
You know, look at the squad now. You know, they've named the 35 squad this morning. He's not in it, so we don't need to worry about him at the moment. But
so you would like to think that they would go with Earl or Ludlam, wouldn't you?
Well, I think, you know, Ben Earl makes a lot of sense. You know, he's a strong carrier. He's in form. He's used to filling in for Billy.
Yeah.
So, you know, at least, you know, he's not the same kind of player as Billy, but he's probably used to playing in a side that needs his sort of set of skills, to borrow a phrase.
But that's what I don't understand, is the fact that, you know, we've got Ludlam, who's played at eight. We've got Earl, that's played a large number of games at eight, or a decent number of games at eight. Yet he chose to pick Tom Curry, who, as far as I can see, hasn't played any real competitive rugby at number eight. Why, it doesn't make any sense.
No, you know, and you've seen, you know, Australia before have gone with Pocock at eight, or South Africa have gone with Lowe at eight, haven't they? But those are teams with really experienced back rows, and really experienced players fitting in. And, you know, in South Africa, at least, certainly went back to, as soon as they could, they got Vermeulen back in there, who's an absolute lump of beef.
Oh, and the Chiefs do it with Kvesuk as well. But what all of those teams have in common is they've got big ball carriers elsewhere putting their hands up and doing the ball carrying bit. Whereas Courtney Laws, as much as, like, I have so much time for Courtney Laws, but he's not a big ball carrier.
No.
That's not what he adds to the team.
No, and Marrow, I mean, and Marrow isn't either. Yules didn't get involved. I mean, he had a couple of handling errors as well. He didn't really do much to help his cause, I don't think. I thought when George Cruz came on, we were started to improve all round. Yeah. You can't kind of attribute that to him directly, but I thought we were in that period of improvement when he was on the pitch. Similarly, Genge and Ludlam. The sooner we get rid of the fucking walking eyebrow, the better. I'm sick to death of the guy. Not even going to mention his name. Absolute wand. I thought he was next to useless. Sinclair didn't have his best game. Atoji didn't have his best game.
I think that was the worst I've seen Sinclair play for England.
I don't know if the transfer thing's been bothering him or what.
Yeah.
But he looked so... You sent me a WhatsApp at the time, Ben, that he looked disinterested. He was getting the ball when we were 5 metres out and dropping to the ground before contact. What's the point?
And he was...
The whole point, yeah, it's to tie people in, but the whole point is to get some forward momentum. But
especially when we didn't have any.
And you know, they've had success with him being a distributor, but that was all he seemed to want to do. It was very strange.
And he shoveled on some shit as well.
Yeah. You know, I think, you know, one bad game certainly doesn't mean he should be dropped or anything like that. But,
oh, no.
You know, but I think, you know, it does have to be noted that he didn't have his best game. I would like to see Genge come in. I think if Watson's fit, he should be playing at fullback. And they've got a real decision to make in the centres, because is Tuolangi going to be fit?
No. No, I think he'd probably be done, I reckon.
Groin strain, so they don't really know. So yeah, for me, it's Genge. I'd like to see Cameron Dickey given a start rather than assuming it's George all the time and see what he's like from the start. I still think you've got to go with Sinclair and just put it down to a bad game.
Yeah, I think
so. I'd like to see Itoji Laws, Cunderwood. I'd like to see Ludlam starting at eight, Ben Earl on the bench. I'll ignore the next position. I think you probably go either Ford, Farrell, Devoto, or Ford, Devoto, Joseph. Farrell, Devoto, Joseph. And I think I would probably go Farrell, Devoto, Joseph. Stick with the wingers and Watson at fullback.
I don't have much. I'm not in much in disagreement with that.
No, I think that would be my back line, I think.
It's especially against Scotland, which is more... I'm a firm believer in horses for courses selections. So like in the World Cup, you know, not playing Ford in that final against D'Alande and those big, powerful South Africans probably wasn't the best option. You could have played Farrell at 10. Tuolangi at 12 and brought in another big guy at 13 to play around with that. I think against Scotland, it's a little bit more mobile and it's a little bit more nimble. So, but what I still would do is I would move Farrell to 10 and I would play Devoto and Joseph. And I would see how that works, because as we've mentioned, Devoto carries hard. And he carries straight, as well as having some pace to go outside shoulder as well. Joseph thrives on outside shoulder ball, so we can start to stretch that. I just think it's easy for teams to defend knowing that Farrell isn't going to run from 12. So, you know, they can rush up, they can blitz on the outside, because you shut down Farrell's passing lane, he's got nowhere to go. Whereas if that's Devoto, for instance, he can step and run straight and carry hard in. But you know, based on your selections there, I agree with Ludlam. I'd like to see Ludlam start at eight, and I'd like to see Earl on the bench and just say, right, well, there's your back row cover. You've got a 6, 7, and 8, you know, cover, and you've got four players that could all pretty much do three jobs. You know, obviously we don't want to see that happen, but if you've got Earl on the bench and you lose Ludlam, you've got some eight cover, but you've also got someone that can play 6 and 7 as well, and then you could look to use your bench. And if you had Cruz coming back in, which I would pick, and then maybe have Laws on the bench, who could also be an emergency six but as well as a second row, so you get a bit of flexibility on your bench.
Yeah, I think I'd go with Cruz and Atoje. And I, well, like I said earlier, I think I would probably start Earl at eight. I agree with your backs. I'm not convinced Farrell's playing very well at the moment, but my sort of gut feeling is to go with him at 10 for this next game with Devoto and Joseph. And yeah, I think Phil probably had the back spot on. I would like to see Ted Hill get a run at some stage in the tournament. But I'm not sure Scotland's probably the best time. I think, you know, don't go mad, but I think a couple of changes do that side
just,
good.
Just a couple of tweaks and a change of emphasis.
So the issue I skipped, I can't see how Ben Youngs can have any future playing for England. His ball is too slow. His box kicking is awful. His pass is actually pretty bad.
It's a mystery. It's a mystery, mate.
It's a really slow pass. If you look at the speed from his hand to the player, it's awful. So it's slow enough him getting to pass the ball, but the pass itself is crap. But then when Willie Hines came on, he was just a slightly better version of shit. He wasn't lightning quick with his passing. And we have so much talent at scrum half.
You could pretty
much pick any other scrum half in the Premiership and they would guarantee they'll do a better job. But also they've got a much better future at potentially offering it. So
yeah. Christ. I mean, I'd like to see Spencer, you know, Robson.
Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, even Will Cliff. Randall from Bristol.
Yeah,
he's a good player. We've got some more.
I was going to say, with the squad, then I'd probably start Hines and have Mitchell on the bench. But
thing Hines did do well was his box kicking was a lot better than Young's. So yeah.
I think if you're going to have, if you're going to pick Willie Hines for that very nature, then to me, it would make more sense to start him as a game controller. If you're going to play a little bit of a box kick game, then you want your box kicking to be better early on to bed yourself into the game rather than towards the end. I don't see what Willie Hines offers as somebody coming off the bench. I think it's a bit odd. A couple more questions. Dan Kier, who's one of our long-time listeners, has said, has a fixture between England and Scotland at Murrayfield ever been anything than a miserable, cold, rainy, dreary, porridge-strewn, haggis-wielding festival of mud and tears watched on by blue-faced pipers? I honestly don't think I can be bothered, and that's without mentioning Ben Youngs. Chris Jones, is the Lensman available to play at 9 against Scotland? Amazon can deliver forward a ball quicker than Youngs, even without Prime. Marty, if Eddie Jones was trying to continue his plan of hard carrying in the centres after Tuilagi came off, then surely Devoto would have been a better option than Joseph, Phil. That's what you said a few minutes ago. Farrell and JJ didn't even cause a ripple, let alone make any line breaks or a decent yardage. Frank Aldinio, is selecting players from the bottom two teams in the Premiership harming our chances? Or is his and Patrick Jackson, does Eddie Jones give a shit about the Six Nations? Is it all about him preparing for the World Cup for him? I don't know. I think it's pretty harsh to say he doesn't give a shit about the Six Nations, but I think he has said in the media around potentially rebuilding the irony is rebuilding without actually doing much rebuilding.
Yeah, that's bollocks. You don't rebuild from losing a World Cup final. You don't need to rebuild from that. What you need to do is work on the little things. And what you need to do is make sure that you're getting the players through for 4 years' time, not continuing to flog the same broken shit like Ben Youngs and Joe Marler.
Yeah. And Steve Hacking has asked, what is England's attack strategy under the new coaching team? And what should it be? Asking the second question for a friend. So the first one, what is England's attack strategy under the new coaching team? And it didn't seem to be too different to the last strategy that we had at the World Cup, which was let's basically try and get the ball to Tuilagi and see what he can do. And offer him as a decoy to get the ball to Johnny May and Anthony Watson, who obviously wasn't fit for this game. But it's hard to keep that game plan going when you don't have the level of ball carriers to get you go forward ball in the first place.
Exactly. So the attack strategy is hard lines, get some go forward ball, suck some people in, and then spin it wide and take advantage. But we went wrong on the first bit. What should it be? It should be flexible. It should have the ability to respond to the pitch, as bonkers as that may sound. And actually, on Saturday, as I say, I think France were great. But there were opportunities there. We just didn't take advantage of them. There was big gaps in behind. There was spaces out wide. There was actually... So in the second half, Johnny May took I think he took a ball, an inside ball off a line out, something like that. Made a half break, made 15 yards. Then somebody did a quick pick and drive off it. I can't remember who. And then there was so much space open wide, and Ben Youngs took about 4 seconds to pass the ball. So we were at times creating opportunities, but yeah. What should it be? I don't think it should be that different from what it is. You just need to pick the players to make it work. And if it's not working, play a tactic to suit the players you've got.
Yeah. Ben, what do you think?
I think England have always sort of used their heaviest carriers sort of off Ford and Farrell as a rule, sort of hitting in the sort of 10-12 channel, a little bit of pick and go, and then the ball sort of out the back behind the carriers. But I think in this game, they just didn't have enough decoy for it to really work. And then when they tried to create a bit of doubt in the defence's mind by battering into it, there was no heavy enough ball carriers to actually create a dent. So they kind of got caught between both stalls there, really. And I think they're going to have to change it up a little bit, because looking at the squad, they just don't have the heavy ball carriers that they do rely on. So,
which almost means they've got to rely on quicker ball. Rely on the speed of the flankers getting around the pitch. So they get around the quick ball to get it out quick. And then you've got Ben Youngs that's taken an age to get it out of the ruck.
Yeah, exactly. It was very confused on Sunday.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good way to put it. And, it might be worth leaving it there for England. I'm sure we could to talk about many things for most of the night. Quick mention for the Premiership Cup. Harlequins put out a near full strength side to demolish Exeter 49-22 yesterday at Sandy Park. So congratulations to them making it to the final of the Premiership Cup. Good chance of silverware.
Rob Shaw's announced he's leaving, isn't he?
Yeah, he's done that today. And he's not mentioned the word retirement either, which makes you think he could be off to France, possibly, or
America.
Japan.
America. That's the big rumour is America.
He's going to get paid somewhere, isn't he? And his missus is a singer, isn't she? Classical singer. Maybe she's going to try and get out to America and do some bits as well. So, yeah, fair play, Chris Robshaw. You know, Harlequin's stalwart. Was he captain when they won the Premiership? I think he was, wouldn't he?
He was,
He's been, you know, a great servant to Harlequins, and fair play and good luck. any other rugby related business for you gents you want to bring up?
I just first round of Super Rugby this weekend, and our surrogate team Sunwolves made a cracking start, beat the Rebels 36-27, and actually looking at the team they've got and the squad they're building, I think they've got a bit of a force to be reckoned with. I'm not saying they're going to beat the Crusaders or anything, but fingers crossed they go well.
Spirit animal, the Sun Wolf. Bless them. They're very, very cute, aren't they? Ben,
not that mascot.
No. Oh, scary, scary bastard.
No, I think Six Nations is the main event this weekend, wasn't it?
Yeah. Oh, we have had another question. It's slightly different, and this might take us down a bit of a rabbit hole, but one to think about is from Steph 9 Lieb. I believe he's a friend of Ben Gulliver, who listened to the pod for the first time last week. Dropped some feedback in, so thank you very much for that. But the question is, what one, if you could make one law change, what would it be? One law change.
Probably the human centipede to try and speed it up.
Oh, that's horrific, isn't it? Did you see the picture of the Exeter one?
Yeah.
And they've conveniently cut out all of the Harlequins. You know, they've chopped the picture, but it's still not very good. What happened to the actual art of box kicking? What happened to actually learning how to box kick under pressure? It's absolutely ridiculous. Yeah. Ben?
The one that always used to drive me mad, which they seem to be slowly phasing out anyway, was the when players got tackled and then they got back to their feet, but the tackler had hold of a shoelace and they would get penalised for it. I always used to think if you could get up, then you weren't held. And the referees seem to be a bit more lenient with that one now. And players are doing a lot of rolling and sort of making a bit of ground on the ground. The other one, I cannot understand why when teams get a penalty and kick to the corner from very close, you know, when they have a line out, they win a penalty at the line out, why they make them kick into touch again? Because they pull the line out back to the 5 metre line anyway.
So you think they should
call
be
it a 5 metre line out?
If you have just, a penalty inside the 5 metre line, you've got an option of scrum. Line out or penalty,
yeah. Totally just sure. save a bit of time. I can't see why they don't do that.
Here's one that I'd like to see. I'd like to see, you know, like in the NFL where you got the hurry up offense, where you can just go in and form up, and you know if you're ready, you can pretty much go. You know, and the defense has to line up. And I would like to see a world where, you know, when teams are trying to slow it down, like yesterday with the French, we had a scrum underneath the French posts, and the game was kind of won by the French, but they were just about to, the clock was rolling like 76 minutes and they were just about to get down. And one of the French props just stood up because, you know, there was nothing wrong. He just stood up.
Yeah.
Now,
just
wasted another 30 seconds. And ironically, Nige actually stopped the clock at that point and said, why did you stand up? There's nothing wrong. Just get on with it, and then put the time back on. And then they had to reset for another 30 seconds. What I'd like to see is if you're an attacking team or a defending team, or more than likely an attacking team, if you get there and form the scrum and you are ready at that scrum formation, there is a shot clock where you've then got 30 seconds to get that scrum going. So the defending team, they can't just meander over, you know, let the clock run down, take the time, stand up, sit down, fall over, whatever. You get like a shot clock. And if you're not ready within that time to scrummage properly, then the opposition get a free kick.
So on yeah, good point. But on that point, there were, England had two scrums down there. French collapsed one and never got penalised for it. And I think that's probably the only thing I would criticise Nigel Owens for in the match at all, was there were a couple that they were obviously getting mullered, and he didn't ping them for it. And then the second one, was exactly the same as that first first scrum. Curry missed the ball and the ball came flying out the side. If you have a proper number eight there, it's a try every time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And Hines got Muller, didn't he? And tried to throw the pass, yeah. Knocked on, and it was all over. And then DuPont kicked it behind with a minute to go. Did you notice that?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, the game was won, and actually, yeah, yeah. It was quite a... Whether you think he did it on purpose, knowing that the game was won and they could only get one score, so it would be... it would be a win anyway, guaranteed. I just think he misread the clock and he just tried to kick it off. Anyway, but yeah, I'd like to see that shot clock for the scrums and just get them formed up, get them done, get them ready. And if you're not ready, free kick and the game is off. It would soon speed up scrum time.
Yeah, and I think it's a real shame because I think scrums are an integral part of rugby. I think they're absolutely necessary and they've become... the enemy of anybody watching a game of rugby.
Or you just do it in the last 10 minutes of each half or the last 10 minutes of the game.
Yeah.
So you do it like a bit like a two after the 2 minute warning. You just, so for the last 10 minutes of the game, the scrum has to be set and ready to go within 30 seconds.
Or you stop the clock. Yeah. The scrums in the last 5 minutes.
And yeah. the clock only starts when the ball gets put in.
So it'll be time on, crouch. So literally like time on, crouch, and then you're into it.
Crouch, bind, engage, time on. Start the time, not engage.
Ooh.
And then there's absolutely no, because there's
yeah, that's true. Yeah. But they're you know, once that engages on, the time...
It's like that...
Well, I suppose then you say time on.
It's like the France-Wales game that took 108 minutes or whatever it was.
It would stop the potentially the early shove as well in the scrum. Because if you go crouch, bind, set, time on, then, you know, what's the point in pushing early to collapse a scrum or whatever? The time's not on. Time's not on. Anyway, yeah. That's what I'd like to see. Just some a little bit more legislation around scrum time. Let's get on to any other business. Ben, any other business for you today?
Like yourself, I watched the Super Bowl last night and I actually managed to doze off for the critical period of the fourth quarter where the comeback happened. And all I can say is if they hadn't have wasted half an hour with a halftime show, I'd have seen the end of the game.
Was quite some sight, Shakira and J-Lo in that halftime show though, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I will admit that. But, you know, for the sake of us people like me, I think they should forego the millions of dollars and just let people watching it on their own in Cornwall get to the end of the match.
Oh, bless. Phil?
So I took Charlie, our little seven-year-old, out for a bike ride on Saturday. And I thought, just go for a little ride down the bottom of the hill, down the road, and then up as far up the hill the other side as he can be bothered going, then we'll turn around and come home. But the little monster powered his way all the way up a 3 kilometre climb up to the very top. And I got to the top and I said, we've got two options. We can go down a hill here and then up another big hill to get back home, or we can just turn around and go. And he went, let's go the long way. So we went for a 9K bike ride, which was 3K of climbing, 2K of descent, and then another 4K of climbing. And not once did he complain. He just kept pedaling the whole way like a little machine.
He's got untold amounts of energy, that kid, though, isn't he?
I know. And he's got the body for cycling as well. I've got the body for downhill.
Yeah. Yeah. Momentum.
Yeah. But yeah, so caned it out, average speed of 13 kilometres an hour, which for his little legs is going some.
Excellent. I haven't really got anything. As I say, I mentioned Doug beat me at golf today, which was really, really disappointing. I won't use excuse like he had 10 shots and all those other bits and pieces. I won't do that because he beat me fair and square and he actually played very well. We're no longer in Europe. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing remains to be seen, but apparently that's all happened now and the world hasn't ended. So, you know, we're all still plodding along. And and that's about it, really. It's been quiet. So we'll look forward to the second round of Six Nations matches. The first weekend was good. Let's hope it gets a bit better for England. And yeah, we'll be back no doubt next week. It's been a pleasure as always. Thanks, gents, for your company and for your insight and chat. And we'll speak to you all next week. Go well. Mm-hmm.